Alright, so you're going to need a clicker. So Aaron's got the box there, so just make sure you get one. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, no problem. Make sure you grab a clicker on the way in. Thank you. Come on in, grab a clicker, have a seat. Be sure to grab a handout and clickers on the way in. Go too far over, you probably won't be able to see well. Yeah, there's plenty of space in the middle too here. Just warning you now, at some point you're going to have to talk to the person next to you during the next hour, so just be aware of that. So if you're really far away from everybody, you're going to have to get cozy. Aaron, are we good? Yeah? Okay. Welcome. How you guys doing? Good? Total silence. You guys are like a class of undergrads, you know. How you doing? All right, there you go. Okay, that's a little bit better. So I'm here to help wake you up today. We're going to talk about presentation skills and designing and delivering effective lecturing. But we're going to do a lot of other things around that as well. My name is Adam Finkelstein. I'm from Teaching and Learning Services, and I'm an educational developer. And basically, what we do at Teaching and Learning Services is we work with faculty and we work with the university on all sorts of different projects, everything from working with one-on-one with faculty members about their courses, doing course design workshops, working with graduate students, all the way up to running sort of big implementations of things at a university, like redesigning our learning spaces or looking at the intersection between teaching and research and things like that. So most of us that are educational developers, our graduate backgrounds are in teaching and learning. So we do degrees in like educational psychology, instructional technology, educational technology, things like that. So the first thing we're going to do is just to get a little bit of background of who's here. You have a clicker in front of you. It's very simple. All you got to do is press a button. And that button corresponds to these buttons that are up here. So 10 all the way to 1. 10 is 0, by the way, on the clicker. So just sort of give an indication of what faculty you're from. We're just going to start things off. The polling is going to adjust as more and more people come in. It's sort of, you'll see at the top there, it's got responses 62. There's more than 62 in the room, so if you haven't pressed the button, let's go. Got things to do. Come on, people. You'll see it go green. No, you can click as many times as you want. It just only accepts the last answer. So once I close the poll, the answers are in. But you'll see a green light. And the green light means that you sent the little button, and I got your answer, and everything's good. 74, pretty close. think we're probably 74, somewhere around 74, maybe a little bit more. If you haven't hit the button, go ahead and hit the button. So let's look at what we got here. We have a large number of medicine and dentistry people. Let's see, we got engineering, a lot of arts, engineering, medicine. That sort of makes sense. It's very similar to the actual spread of how big our faculties are. Okay, 81. So that sort of gives me an idea of exactly how many people we are, because we're going to ask a couple of these questions as we go. First thing, so I'm going to close the poll. You can press the button, but it's not going to go green, so you can't answer anymore. Talk about the three sort of big things we're going to do today. And I'm sort of tethered to this microphone, and I have to keep the microphone on, even though I definitely have a teacher voice, and I could fill the room without it, but I've been told I have to be recorded, so here we go. First is become familiar with learning-centered approaches and learning-centered principles in designing and delivering lectures. Become aware of a lot of different range of teaching strategies. So even though lecturing is very, very common, it is definitely not the only thing you can do. And even while lecturing, you can intersperse all sorts of interesting activities. We are going to do some of them as we go through the morning. The last is sort of consider how you might want to use some of these in your own strategy, as strategies for yourself in your own teaching. So if we just go from here, which is a good question, is how much teaching experience do you have right now? Everything from none to taught multiple courses. So none, offered tutorials, guest lectured, taught part of a course. Go for it. I should get some music. All right, we're almost reaching that 80 mark, which is sort of my cue. Yes. No, you can throw it in. I mean, if you taught a kid 12 or something like that, or a CJEP or something like that, sure. All right, 2 seconds more. Last chance. All right, we're done. All right, a bunch of you, well, actually, we have a pretty good spread, all the way from none to tutorials and lectured, and some of you have sort of taught entire courses or multiple courses, but most people sort of seem to be on this side, which is you've done a little bit or dipped your toes into classes here and there. I assume a lot of you have taken classes, which is, of course, the interesting thing of what sort of strategies you've been experienced to besides someone at the front standing up and lecturing at you all day. So we're going to talk about that a little bit farther forward. So the second thing is, how confident are you in your ability to deliver a lecture or a tutorial? Everything from you're a total rock star to completely terrified. So give me a good indicator where you guys are on that spread. Yeah. Sure. What will you be doing? Pick one. All right, come on. Here we go, last few. All right, let's see. Most people are reasonably confident. That's good. We have a few rock stars and a few people that are totally terrified, but most people are sort of in the middle. Some nervous, I guess I have to do this as an example. All right, so that's good. We'll get a little bit of breaking down some of those things as we go in the next little while. Basically, this sort of overview agenda, we've done some introductions. We're going to clarify our goals, which I think is one really important thing that we're going to deal with when we're teaching. And since a lot of you are graduate students, you may be in situations where you're actually not in control of the goals of the course. But it's really important for you to get an idea of what good learning outcomes or good goals that you want to set out for a course are. So at the very least, you'll be able to recognize, you know, when things might be a problem in terms of the goals of a course. And then we're going to talk about strategies. And the last thing we're going to sort of end with is this death by PowerPoint, which is I'm sure a lot of you have either experienced or have inflicted one of the two. And we're going to try and break that down so that you not only have to,
Well, you might experience death by PowerPoint at some point. You can't avoid that. But hopefully you're not going to ever inflict it on somebody else, which is a really important thing, especially as we as you start to develop a lot of the teaching skills you're going to be doing in your classes. And you'll see that students will react very violently if you decide to use PowerPoint in a particularly offensive and inflicting way. Okay, next question. What for you is the biggest challenge in designing and delivering a lecture? Everything from knowing your audience to improving it for the future. What do you think is your, what's your personal biggest challenge? Sure. All right, most people are the time for practice and preparation. Well, that's good because you won't always have the luxury, but usually you do want to have time to prepare and practice. There's a lot of interesting things. I think the important thing about the challenge is that all of these are challenges. And at some point you're gonna run into every single one of these. Everything from, you know, you may not know your audience all that well, or you might go in and give a lecture and realize that actually people are at a much higher level than you visually anticipated. Or you might be in a situation where you pick a few topics and you realize that you can only do half of what you actually thought you could do when you get into that hour. Or you might start to engage the participants and it's, let's say, 8:30 in the morning and you have a bunch of undergrad students and half of them haven't even finished their coffee yet. And you're going to realize that engagement is a lot harder than you might think. We don't make it easy by putting undergraduate students in a class at 8:30 in the morning, especially on, let's say, a Friday or something like that. Or worse, you actually have a tutorial you have to give at like 4:30 on a Friday afternoon. That might be just as bad as 8:30 in the morning. Time for practice and preparation and using technology, which of course changes every 15 minutes. And whatever you're using right now, you're probably going to have to change by the time you're actually teaching with it. And then, of course, improvement, where you may not actually be able to get feedback right away from the students. So how can you even cue up on ideas from the people that you're actually talking to and you're connecting with, whether you're actually connecting with the students in the group that you have, as an example? So I just want to stop for a second and talk about the way that we at Teaching and Learning Services sort of give a big picture about how learning happens and how you might want to design the activities and courses for that type of learning. So here is an example. Learning is always in the middle because learning is really the important thing here. That's why we're all in the room. We're all in the room to learn. Not only have the students learn, but also have the instructor learn from the students as well. And the other important things that you see here is you know, any one of these four major points. And the point of a circle is that you can really enter into the idea of designing a particular topic or class that you're going to do at any of these four points. Most people start at the very top, which is, what do I want to teach? Okay, I have these three things I have to cover. Let's say my instructors told me I got to cover these five things about DNA replication. Okay, that's my content. So what are you going to teach in your course? So what is the content you're going to cover? The second thing is, well, what do you want the students to learn? You might have the content that's here. Okay, but if it's just about content, they could read the book. So what do you want them to learn? What's the whole idea? What are the big major points that you want to try and get across? Or what are the trying points that you want the students to be able to take away or construct through a session? The third thing here is, okay, well, so how do you know that they're going to learn what you wanted them to learn in the first place? That's really what assessment is. So you can sort of tell if they learned what you had hoped that you wanted them to learn. And strategies is the activities that you're going to design in the particular class where you meet your students so that they can learn what you want them to learn. So you have sort of your outcomes on one end. So this is what I want students to learn, and this is how I'm going to be able to tell that they learned it. And then you have the black box in the middle. The black box is what we do. We call a course, right? So you go into the black box, and all these things happen. At the end, you do an assessment. Everybody did better. Oh, wonderful. We're all good. Off we go. And the question is, how do you operate the black box? What do you do inside this black box? And that's really what is important about strategies. But before we really get to strategies, the first thing we really have to think about is clarifying our goals. And what are our learning outcomes? And what do we do with learning outcomes? And how do we deal with them? So the first thing is, well, what are learning outcomes? And you'll get all these slides later, so don't madly copy them down. I mean, you can copy down main points if you really want to, but it's really not about writing down what I'm saying. But more just sort of think about it. So learning outcomes are basically statements about three different types of or categories of things. One is knowledge. That sort of makes the most sense. So what do you want students to learn? So core knowledge that you're thinking about. The second sort of area is skills. So, for example, I want students to be able to do a particular type of incision and sew in a particular type of way. That's a skill, psychomotor skill, something you need to learn as well. You have to have knowledge as well as that skill in that example. And the third thing are attitudes, affective issues. You know, I want students to be able to understand, like, or go through issues of becoming a global citizen. So, you know, I want to be able to, ensure that students are going to be good doctors. And we have to think about what does that mean as an example. So, the thing about useful learning outcomes is that in order for outcomes to be useful at all, they have to focus on student learning. You have to focus on what you want the students to learn, not what you want to teach them. What do you want the students to learn at the end of the day? And so then that's the question, well, what is the difference? What does that mean? The second thing is that they have to be clear and concise. If learning outcomes are totally fuzzy and they don't really make sense to you, they're sure as hell not going to make the sense to anybody else in the room either. And if nobody understands what the point is or why you're here in the first place, then you're not going to get anything out of the session, either as an instructor or as a student. The third is, well, in order to assess a learning outcome, you've got to have a goal that's somewhat measurable. If it's not measurable, how will you possibly be able to know that the students achieved that goal that you set out in the first place? You know, for example, if I want you to be able to climb a mountain, that's the goal. Well, the assessment is, did you get it to the top of the mountain, right? It's pretty simple. It's easy to figure that part out. But when things get a little bit more complex, a little bit fuzzier, you've got to be able to determine how am I going to know that they met this goal. And the fourth thing is that they've got to be achievable. So if you've got, a 1-hour session and one of your goals is that you're going to make people a better human being in that 1 hour, I mean, we've got to be a little bit realistic about what we're able to accomplish. Now, you might be able to inspire them to become a better human being, but I think, how are you going to measure that out of that 1 hour they became a better human being? That's really another good question. So the second thing is, well, what are the purpose of learning outcomes? What are learning outcomes for? They're basically for both instructors and for students, and that's what they're designed for. The first thing is, for instructors, what learning outcomes do is they basically allow you to steer decisions about content, strategies, and assessments that you're going to do in your course. And what learning outcomes basically are is a roadmap for your course. And you can always look back and go, okay, well, this is a really great topic, and it's really interesting to me because it's my research, but is it really one of the goals that I want in this course? Is it something that the students really have to wrestle with, or is this just sort of my pet idea, as an example? So you always have to keep coming back. Every time you think about anything you're going to do in your class, well, what's the goal? What's the point? Why am I trying to do this? And what's the goal in the course that I'm trying to achieve? For students, it basically makes the instructor's decisions explicit. When you go to a course, you've taken courses as an undergrad, and you get a course outline, and there's a description that's relatively vague, and no learning outcomes of any kind whatsoever, do you have any idea what the next 3 months are going to be like? No. And that's really what goals are designed for as a student. It gives you the same roadmap that the instructor has or that you would have if you're teaching, gives it to the students, makes it transparent. Here's what we're going to do. It's all very clear. The more you hide those sort of things, the more difficult it is for anybody to figure out what's going on. You really want to make everything clear. At the end of this course, you will be able to X, Y, Z. Very simple. Or these 5 things, or these 6 things. Usually course goals, giant course goals are around 5 or 6 is probably the max you'd ever be able to do in 3 months. But these are sort of things that you learn over time, and you have to really practice designing and writing these learning outcomes. It's not something that just sort of comes naturally. And we'll talk about that in a second, because we're going to get a chance to do that. So, first thing is, I want you to answer this question individually. Do you think this is a good learning outcome for a course? Yes or no? In this course, students will be able to understand the basic principles of accounting. So go ahead and... keep going. Okay. Awesome. 50-50 split. My favorite type of question. Oh, I couldn't have asked for a better response. Okay, now, this is really good. So we have a 50-50 split if you think it's a good learning outcome or not. So what I want you to do is think about why, turn to your neighbor for 2 or 3 minutes, probably we'll give it close to 5 minutes, and say why. Why did you pick yes or no, and why do you think it's a good learning outcome? Go ahead.
If you're too far away, get closer to somebody.
Okay, 30 more seconds.
Okay, so now's the part of the time where I need volunteers. So yes or no? Less fast. All right, I will talk less fast. Yes or no, and why? Give me somebody throw their hand up. Yes. Others. Okay. Others? Anybody else? Yeah? Okay. Okay. Others? Yeah? A contrarian. Okay. Any other ones? Anybody else? From over here, yeah? And, yeah, go ahead. Okay. All right, so let's keep all this in mind. Sounds like the people that are on either side are relatively convinced of their that they are correct. Let's look at ways of critiquing learning outcomes, then we'll go back and critique the one that was there. First, isn't learning centered, focused on what students will learn? Okay, just think about that for a second. Is it measurable? Okay. Is it achievable? Is it clear and concise? And is it appropriate to the level of students? Okay, those are some things to think about. So let's go back here for a second. How will you know if students understood the basic principles of accounting? Give me an idea. How will you know? Exam? Okay. Well, how do you know they will understand the basic principles? What does understand the basic principles mean? Okay, that... good point, but that's not what it says, right? It says, understand the basic principles. You should have criteria for it. Okay. So understand isn't enough? Ah, okay. So now we're getting somewhere. So how do you measure understanding? Others about how do you, yeah, go ahead. Okay, so you're changing the language here. You said apply, contrast, compare. Okay. Anybody else have some thoughts? So let's take another example. I want you to understand how to drive a car. How will I know if you understood how to drive a car? What would I do? Sorry? If I don't have an accident, okay, will I then understand that you know how to drive a car? Okay, give me something else. What else could I do? Like it's in the passenger seat. Will I understand how you drive a car? Okay, so now you're talking about can they apply it or can they actually maybe describe the parts of the principles to somebody else or maybe they could explain it to someone else or something like that. Okay, so now we're starting to get somewhere. Do you see where I'm getting at? Understand is one of those words that nobody really understands. Because how do you know if you've understood something? Understood could mean anything from you can repeat it like a parrot to being able to actually apply it in new situations. It's a type of verb that is a sort of a red flag on learning outcomes that says, whoa, how are you going to figure that one out? And you see it all the time. Understand is a very common one you see on learning outcomes. When you look at it, it's very, very difficult to deconstruct that. How do you understand something? How do you understand a topic? Now, I could have said something like, in this course, students will be able to describe the basic principles of accounting. Ah, describe is a little bit easier. What can I do to figure out if people can describe something? Write it down. There you go. Very simple, measurable, easy. Then we get the second part of the learning outcome, basic principles of accounting. Now, there's another weird one, basic. Basic to who? Basic to the student? Basic to the PhD in accounting? Basic to the expert in accounting? You might say, the principles of accounting according to blah, 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 blah. Or these four basic pieces of accounting, or something along those lines. But the word of basic is also another one of those red flags. So these are really critical as you go forward looking at what you want students to learn is just keep coming back to, okay, how am I going to know? How am I going to know? How am I going to know? When you use words like understand, it's very, very difficult to figure that out. When you use very clear things like being able to apply in a particular situation, being able to describe, I want students to be able to repeat. Those are very low levels. But I want students to be able to evaluate the basic principles of accounting. Ah, now we're getting higher up. I want them to be able to analyze the basic principle of accounting and apply them in a particular situation. Now we're getting at language or verbs specifically that are much more measurable than understand. And it's not that understand isn't measurable. The problem is that everybody has a different understanding of what understand means. That's the problem. And what you need to do is you need to make sure that there's language that's clear for everyone. Because it has to be clear for you, and it's got to be clear for the students. Because if it's clear for you and not the students, then you're lost. If it's clear for the students, not for you, well, then I don't know how that happened in the first place. So that's a great example, and that's something you probably have seen. So if you look at a lot of learning outcomes, you're going to see a lot of things like that. Understand the basic of this. Understand the basic of that. And you have to sort of keep coming back to, how am I going to figure this out? And worse, not only how am I going to assess it, but how am I going to get students to the point where I can then assess it? So understand the basic principles. Does that mean they have to read them and then just spit them back? Does that mean they have to actually be able to do problems of accounting? I mean, is it all theoretical? Are we talking here about, am I giving them cases for them to work through? So that's where the strategy becomes difficult, because if the outcome's unclear and then the assessment's unclear, the strategies become complicated as well. So that's something to think about going forward with learning outcomes, and I'm going to leave it there. Usually what we would do with faculty members, as an example, is we go through a whole morning of how to write learning outcomes and different levels of learning that we're talking about, everything from basic level all the way up to the higher level. But in a lot of situations, you're going to be faced with problems where you're given the learning outcomes. Or worse, you know, you're given no learning outcomes. And what you can do is help, especially when you're working with a particular course, let's say you're TAing in or giving a lecture in or anything like that, is ask the instructor, well, what's the main point of this course? Like, what's the main point of this particular session? What do you want the students to learn here? What are we trying to do? Those are things that can help decode some of that information for you to make it a lot easier. I mean, you may not be able to, let's say, work with a particular faculty member and give them an entire morning session on how to write learning outcomes. But at the same time, the more you know about that, the more that you'll be able to do with it yourself. So, next thing. The next thing is knowing your context. And there's a really great little clip here that I want to play for you, which is really about, you know, knowing your audience.
That must be the first architect now. Ah, yes, it's Mr. Wiggin of Ironside and Malone.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is a 12-story block combining classical neo-Georgian features with all the advantages of modern design. The tenants arrive in the entrance hall here, are carried along the corridor on a conveyor belt in extreme comfort and past murals depicting Mediterranean scenes towards the rotating knives. The last 20 feet of the corridor are heavily soundproof. The blood pours down these chutes and the flesh slurps into these large...
Excuse me.
Hmm?
Did you say knives?
Rotating knives, yes.
Are you proposing to slaughter our tenants?
Does that not fit in with your plans?
So this is one of those really important things about knowing who your audience is, knowing who you're dealing with, and it's sort of a roundabout way of thinking about the class that you're teaching. First is, who are your students? You know, in this case, he was pitching a slaughterhouse as opposed to pitching a particular wonderful little apartment for tenants. The second thing to think about is, well, how big is your class? Where is it physically? Like, is it online? I mean, is it all online? Is it something that's like you're in a lecture hall? Are you in a small classroom, a big classroom? And last, you know, what strategies do you want to achieve your outcomes? So these are sort of, so the context is wrapping around all the different parts of your teaching and learning. And it's sort of things that you have to keep thinking about. So now I'm going to give you some really interesting and scary things to think about when you think about your students. Your students were born in 1993 and 1994. Now let's stop for a second and just think that over for a minute here. They were born in 1993 and 1994, okay? That's what we're talking about. Now, 1993, 1994, that didn't seem all that long ago for me. I don't know about for you. But most of the students in your class are going to be born at that point. They've always worn bike helmets. They've always worn bike helmets. It's never been. Has anybody here, when you were a kid, when you were riding bikes, did you wear a bike helmet? No, I didn't wear a bike helmet. Some people did. Probably the really advanced ones. You guys wore bike helmets. All of us, you know, we were like not wearing bike helmets and riding in the middle of the street. For them, Amazon has never been just a river. Star Wars has always been a film and not a defense strategy. Now, you got to know a little bit about the U.S. culture for that one. This is Reagan and Star Wars. And another really interesting point, for most of their lives, maintaining relations between the U.S. and the rest of the world has been a woman's job in the State Department. Now, that's a really interesting thing to think about. Now, these all come from something called the Mindset List. And every year they do this in the States. A lot of it is very U.S.-centric, so you'll find a lot of cultural references that are just too specific for our situations. But there's a couple really interesting ones. And what's neat about it is that you can look at every year, okay, my students this year that are coming in at first year, what do they experience? What's their sort of background? So this is sort of just a quick snapshot of who the students are, who your students are. So one thing you have to think about as you're looking at your students is, what are the motivations for taking this course? Is it required? Is it elective? Do they want to be there? Are they planning a future career in this particular discipline? If you've got a group of students and you're doing, let's say, a physics tutorial, and they're actually planning on all majoring in physics, it's a little bit different than if they're all planning on being, let's say, anthropologists, and physics is just something they have to do. So now you've got to think about that. And it has to do with your strategies, has to do with your motivation, has to do with figuring out what the relevance is. What is the relevance of physics to anthropology students, as an example? What are their expectations? I mean, do they just want to pass and get the hell out? I mean, is this sort of some sort of particular issue that they're really interested in? What's their prior knowledge? You know, if you're talking in your own discipline to a group of students that have never experienced it before, you really have to be aware of what's their background. How much do they know about what they're talking about? You fire a whole slew of acronyms at them, especially medicine as an example, and their eyes are going to go wide like this, and they're going to look at you like, I don't know what the hell this person's talking about, and, you know, it's probably best if I just quietly leave this room. What barriers to learning might they experience? A huge number of percentage of students have any sort of particular mental health issue. Disabilities, like learning disabilities, have been on the rise for the last number of years. Maybe not on the rise, but at least the diagnosis of them as well. How many students that you have in your class are actually manic depressive? I was teaching a class once, a class of 25. And in one semester, I had one student who was assaulted during the term. And the second one was diagnosed with major depression out of 25 students. I'd never experienced that before. And those are sort of the realities where, you know, the course is one part of students' lives. And you might find a student struggling in a particular corner, and then you go and talk to them, you find out they're struggling for a lot of different reasons, and none of it has to do with academic content. So something to keep in mind. Who are your students? What are barriers exist? You might have a student that's working full-time. After they finish school, they go and they work, you know, they go work, like, let's say, a six-hour shift every single night. And they come in and they're barely awake. And they're not falling asleep because you're boring, although they might be falling asleep because you're boring. But hopefully not, because by the end of this, you'll have great strategies. You won't have to worry about that. But they might be falling asleep because they're literally completely tired. So it's something you have to think about as we go forward. Class size and location. You know, are you teaching in a room that looks like this or like this? A small room that looks like this? Tables you can move around? Small tablet chairs you can move around? Whiteboards you could write on? Do you have to project? Do you not have to project? Are you working in sort of a classroom that's a lot more active like this, where students are working in teams? You're doing a lot of team-based learning, as an example. So the next thing is, or the last sort of thing, which is what we're going to spend a little bit more time, is choosing our strategies. So one of the things I wanted to get from you is to finish this sentence. I learn best when what? Give me an example, somebody. I learn best when I do something. You learn best when what? You. When you teach a course. Go ahead. When you choose to do something yourself. When you have a problem that you're trying to solve. You have examples in practice. I learn best when the teacher's interested. Oh, you're only here? Yeah, go ahead. When you get to talk in class. When you're watching something. Come over here. I learn best when you're taking notes. Any other ones? When you like it. When you have clickers. Nobody said they learn best when I lecture at you. But that's kind of interesting. And I think that's one of the points I want to bring up as well. So let's think about learning for a second. And if we really want to boil learning research down to four bullet points, and this is always fun when you take an entire field and you boil it down to three bullet points that you can sort of figure out by sitting around a coffee table. This is what research is all about. Basically, we know that learners create knowledge actively and uniquely, and they learn best when they're able to connect new to existing. So you have some sort of knowledge, and you're looking at new knowledge, and you need to connect the two. In other words, trying to make things as authentic as possible. And if you think back to a lot of situations you've been in, it's one of the reasons why, especially in medicine, they try to get you into the ward as fast as possible. So you can sort of see what the point of all of this is, as an example. Connecting new knowledge to existing knowledge. The second thing is that students need to be able to focus attention on the learning experience. Let's talk about the myth of multitasking for a second. You cannot check your email and be on Facebook and learn at the same time. It's impossible. And in fact, actually, if you look at all the research on the brain, there's no such thing as multitasking. Multitasking does not exist. There is switch tasking, and you can move from one task to another very quickly, but you can only attune to one thing at a time. So when you have, let's say, 10 or 15 people in a room, and you're lecturing at them, and they're surfing Facebook, they're listening to you passively. But if you really want them to do something, let's say have a discussion. Can you really have a discussion and surf Facebook at the same time? Can anybody do that? No. In fact, what happens is, especially if you have, you know, a phone or a BlackBerry, if you're having a discussion, and this happens at the dinner table, you're talking, the phone buzzes, you look down and say, what? What was that again? Well, why are you saying that? Because you got distracted. Total distraction, you deal with it, you come back. Your brain's switching, okay? You can't attune to both at the same time. So this is one of those things when the students tell you, oh, no, I can surf Facebook and be engaged in class at the same time. Eh, you can call BS on that one. It's not going to happen. It does not work. I forgot I'm being recorded. I better be careful. So they've got to be able to focus attention. You've got to be able to make sure everybody is engaged in a particular task and is focusing on what you're trying to do. Now, you might be able to do that in a lecture if you're really good at engaging people and connecting with people on a particular topic. But you really got to think to the next level is, what are you going to get them to do? The third thing is receiving appropriate feedback early and often. How many times have you experienced when you've been in a class and the only feedback you've ever gotten is a midterm and final exam? How many people have just had a midterm and final exam in a course? How many people have just had a final exam? Okay. How many of you took that final exam where it was just the final exam and you did as well as you thought you did? Yeah? Okay, good. Small minority, but that means you really knew exactly what you're supposed to do. One of the things about feedback that we know about from the research is that the feedback has to be close to the event. Okay? One of the problems with the 100% final exam, first of all, the fact that that final exam is designed not to give you feedback, but really designed to sort of test all of your knowledge and figure out what you know and what you don't, is that you have no opportunity to know if you're on the right track. In theory, that's sort of what a midterm is supposed to do. Except for midterms graded, the stakes are really high. And sometimes you do a midterm and all the course material behind the midterm is over. And then you do the next half. And it's like, well, what about the stuff I really wasn't sure about in that first half? Well, it's over now. We tested you. We're moving on. So one of the things about feedback is that, especially if you're thinking about with your students, you've got to give feedback early and often. That means smaller things that are more often rather than big things at the end. And that's really a shift to what they call formative assessment, which means assessment as you go. So you can get a guide as to what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. You know, the last thing you want to do is, let's say you're working on a patient in a ward, and the only time they tell you if you did anything right or wrong is when they're dead, right? That's really not a terribly effective way of learning. Well, they've died, so I guess you did something wrong in there. Not really great for you. Not really great for anybody. Really what you want is you do something and then say, listen, you know what, next time, do it this way. Or next time, here's something you can do to improve. Okay, good. Next step. Here's some feedback on the next step. Here's some feedback on the next step. The closer that feedback is, the better off everyone's going to be. And the last thing is that we know learners create knowledge actively and uniquely, and they learn best when they work on engaging collaborative experiences. One of the most interesting things about education is that we do all sorts of evaluation individually, and we make everybody do everything on their own, with their own books, with their own materials, and then you graduate, and you never, ever do anything individually again. Everything you do from then on is on a team, in a collaboration in some way, and you have to work with other people. So it's one of those great things that we want to try and do in university where, you know, we want to make it a little bit more like real life. If you're a doctor, or if you're going to be a doctor, you will never, ever, ever be working alone. Ever. You're always working on some sort of team. And you always have to interact with people in one way or the other. And if you never have that opportunity to work with other people, then you never practice it. If you never practice it, you never know what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong, and you can never get better. So that's one of the things that's really important, is we've got to set up situations for our students that are, first, engaging. They've got to be interesting. They've got to be useful. I mean, if we create cases that are that students will never see or that are really not authentic to them, it's not going to be very helpful. And we want to have collaborative experiences where people work together. There's a great instructor in psychology that teaches statistics. And one of the things that she does every day, and talking about stats and to make stats engaging, which is not always that easy. I don't know how about you, but how engaging you find statistics. But every day she brings in something from the newspaper and puts it down and say, okay, this was in today's newspaper. Let's look at what they're saying. That's authentic. That's engaging. And that's something where they can work together. But it's real. It's a real problem. It's not, okay, let's solve X, Y, and Z. It's like, here's a real issue, and let's figure out what the statistics are behind it. So the best way to think about strategies for learning, or one of the ways you can think about strategies for learning, is by thinking about it in these four different areas. The first is every strategy has sort of an introduction and an orientation. You sort of got to get everybody ready for learning. So we're all going to sort of orient ourselves. We're going to figure out this is what we're going to do for the day. We're going to try and motivate people, get people interested in it. You might jump around, do a little crazy stunt in the beginning of class, something like that. We're introducing and getting people ready for a particular topic. You might sort of tell people what the goals are. Here's what we're going to do today. Here's the agenda, things like that. The second thing is even active strategies where you're discussing and collaborating, they all have some element of informing, which means you, as the instructor, are telling the students something. It might be, okay, here's the activity we're going to do. We're going to start with this. You're going to talk to your friends for 2 minutes. And here are the questions you have to answer. We're going to come back to here. Or it might be, now here's my 10-minute lecture. Or here's my hour lecture. Or here's my 3-hour lecture. Or hopefully not longer than that. So there is some sort of element of informing. The third part is active learning. Or another way you could think about it is practice and feedback. You've got to have an opportunity, the students specifically, have to have an opportunity to practice what you're talking about. If you've informed a little bit, they have to work on it. They have to work on it, let's say, by going through a problem together, or working on a problem, or talking about a topic with each other, or having a discussion, or doing something active. They have to get their brains moving. And the fourth thing is, you've got to close off the particular topic and give people an opportunity to reflect on what happened. So what were the main things we covered today? Get everybody to synthesize a little bit, things like that. Now, what's really interesting is that there's lots and lots of examples. Can you think of any examples where you've had one of these and not the other? Anybody? Give you a hint. Most lectures, they basically do introduce and orient and inform it. There's very little practice and feedback and active learning, if at all. And closing a reflection might be, hold on, I got 2 more slides. As if somehow covering those 2 slides, you know, will somehow make you learn it. You ever heard about the lecturing being compared to the fire hose model of learning? Do you know what the fire hose model is? The fire hose model of learning is basically, I stand up here with a fire hose, and I open it up, and I hose all of you down like this, okay, and you all have buckets. And basically, you try and catch as much of the water as I spray out. And then at the end of the class, I go around with a measuring stick, and I measure how much water is in each bucket, and whoever has the most water gets the highest grade. That's basically the fire hose model of teaching and learning, otherwise known as the great lecture, right? So this is one of the important things, is trying to get away from just informing students and giving students an opportunity for practice and feedback. And oftentimes what we'll say is, oh, well, I'm informing them now, and then they're going to do all the practice and feedback outside of class. Well, it's fine to do practice outside of class, but what about the feedback? So they're practicing, and there's nobody there to give them any feedback. Now, in order to practice without feedback, you've had to have feedback first at some point. You know, it's like you do all these wonderful problems, and then you get back to the class and realize that you did all of them wrong. Nothing more demotivating than to find out 5 hours of work that you've done has, you know, totally been a waste of time. So it's something to think about. So now, yes? Well, active learning means getting students active. And active learning is, in the classroom. could, yeah? It becomes much more hard. But I'll tell you what. We're going to do it right now. So it's a good segue. You're right that engaging students in a larger environment is much more difficult, but there are lots of different strategies that you can do that. And you have a wonderful little handout that you've picked up, and we're going to talk about this right now. So one of the things about active learning is that active learning does not mean just asking a question and the same four people in the front answer. That means it's active for those people, but everybody else sits there and nods their heads and watches. Active learning means everybody is active. So that gets a lot more complicated. So suddenly you think that, well, if I just give a lecture and ask questions and get a couple of responses, I'm doing active learning. You're doing a little bit of active learning, and it's active for a small number of people, but how can you get everybody involved? So give me an example, just on a brainstorm out of the top of your head. How can I get everybody involved in a big environment? What can I do? Small group activity. Turn to your neighbor. Talk to a small group. Work on a problem. Things like that. And there's a lot of examples. So what we're going to do for the next couple minutes is we're going to spend 5 minutes with this handout. So what you're going to do is take a minute, look at the handout, and you're going to see a whole bunch of different strategies, one from each area, a couple from each area. There's going to be strategies for informing, and there's going to be strategies for introducing, there's going to be strategies for active learning and practice and feedback, and there's going to be strategies for closing. So take a look at that for a couple of minutes. We're going to do the individualized reading part of the session. So read through, and while you're reading, okay, check off a strategy that you particularly think is kind of cool, that you'd like to try, that you've never seen before, that you want to know more about. So let's take 5 minutes, go through that. Okay, once you're done, even if you're not done, it's okay, you can keep reading. We're going to do something called a one-minute paper. Basically, take a blank piece of paper, or the back of that one, or anything like that, and pick one of the strategies that you'd like to try, and write down the answer to these two questions. Why'd you choose the strategy, and how would you use it? If you haven't finished yet, it's okay. Just keep reading. Just take a moment and write all those out. Everybody still writing? Give me a hand. Let me see a hand if you're still writing. Okay. Got 30 seconds. Now, I could, in a large class, even such as this, collect all those answers with your name on them and give you feedback on them, which is actually what a one-minute paper is great for. You can do it with large environments, 300-400 students. You can burn through them very fast. And usually it's 1 minute. 1 minute, question, go. And it's amazing sort of what you can synthesize in 1 minute. So now that you have all that wonderful information written down, we're going to do something together. So same sort of groups that you had before, you know, either in twos or threes, or the people around you, describe the class that you're going to be teaching, or sort of your area that you're going to be teaching, maybe your domain or a particular course that you have in mind, and the strategy that you picked, and think about, you know, why did you pick the strategy and how would you use it? So we're just going to sort of give about 10 minutes to work through your group, talk a little bit about it, take some turns, talk a little bit about that, and then we're going to bring it together in a wrap-up. Okay? Go for it. You got 10 minutes. Go. I'm going to give you a halfway through warning. Okay, you should be about halfway through. Okay, 3 minutes. They push a little bit, so they won't break. Minute and a half. Okay, 1 minute. Okay, 30 seconds. Okay. All right, let's bring it back here. Now, you'll notice that it's not easy to stop discussion, and that's a good thing. Why? Because people are actually talking to each other, and then hopefully wrestling through some of these issues. So I wanted to just grab a couple of things from people. Anybody want to share the particular strategy, why they'd like to do it, etc.? Anyone? Or you just wanted to share with your neighbor? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a journal reflection in some way. That's great. Great. Other examples? Either things they tried or want to try? Yeah. Money's point's a fun one, especially when you get an unexpected answer. You're like, oh, I just spent 10 minutes on that and they didn't understand anything I talked about. Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, and a one-minute paper you can do in a very large scaled-up environment. So there's lots of examples of people doing one-minute papers in 400 or 500-person classes, and it's just, you know, pass it down, collect it, and bang, 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 bang. It does not take very long. It's surprisingly fast to grade something that people only write in 1 minute. Now, 10 minutes might be a little longer, but 1 minute is actually pretty powerful. Other ones, examples. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a perfect example. So there was a lot of talking. But then I asked, okay, now everybody, somebody want to volunteer. So it takes a little bit more, you know, that you want to share it with everybody. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And you saw sort of some of that where it was, you know, the best type of clicker questions, if you ever do them in class, are ones where you get 50-50 splits. Because then people argue. And you get sort of this idea that, well, no, I think it's this. No, I think it's that. And that's exactly the idea behind the debate. You get people to take a position. You take a position, you get an argument. An argument means, as long as it's not out of control, an argument means that people actually are wrestling with the problem, that they have something vested in it. So that's a great example. One more. One more, one more, one more. Yeah. About the same thing, or... I can say that I'm from education, so it's okay. Great. So that's good. So, I mean, at least you've got a little bit of an idea, and those strategies we've handed you are like a small slice. There's some references there. There are books and books on active learning strategies and strategies for lecturing, all sorts of things like that that are out there. So based on research, based on examples. So if you're interested, there's lots more where that came from. But how many of you are at some point going to be lecturing in one way or the other? Okay. All right, so the rest of the time we're going to focus on guidelines for informing, because I think that's one of those things that's really important, and that, you know, you're going to do some type of informing, hopefully not a three-hour lecture, and hopefully you'll have a lot of active learning strategies in there interspersed. But if you're going to do some informing, here are some things we need to think about. One is, you know, show the big picture. This is sort of that idea of what is the whole point. You know, that map that I showed you. The idea of strategies embedded within a larger context. Why are we here? This course is about X. Why is X important? That sort of whole big picture concept that you give people allows a real opportunity for people to sort of see connections between things. Another one is orienting people. Okay, we're going to start here. We're going to do this. And after this, we're going to do this. And when we do this, we're going to be done. This is going to take you 5 minutes. Every time I gave you, here's a 10-minute activity, I'm giving you cues. 3 minutes to go. 2 minutes to go. It gives you an idea of what you, the pace that you have to move, etc. Things like that. Cover only a few main points. Guaranteed, you'll get through less than you think. And it takes a long time to really get an idea of how long it really takes to talk about a particular topic. So, I mean, I can set out a series of slides, and I have a pretty good idea how long each one's going to take, but things might get sidetracked. And then you have to sort of be able to move on your feet a little bit and figure out, okay, if I don't move this here, here, and here, I'm not going to get to that last point. Is that last point important? Then I got to figure out what to do. Transitions. When you move from one piece of one activity to another, you've got to make that connection about why you're, or how you're transitioning from one thing to another. There are some really nice sort of serendipitous moments where, you know, talking about strategies, we're going to actually talk about that right now. So it's that that looking for those opportunities for transition. Engaging participants, 10 to 15 minute blocks. You can't really hold your attention longer than 10 to 15 minutes. In anything, if you're listening, it's very, very difficult. You have to be an incredibly engaged speaker to get people to really listen to you for that period of time. Anybody ever heard of TED Talks? You know why TED Talks are 18 minutes maximum? Because that's the longest you're ever going to really get people to sit there. And those 18 minutes, when you watch those people give those presentations, those are some of the best in the world in those 18 minutes. So one of the things you want to think about, and this is a good example, what we've done this morning, a little bit of talking, do something. A little bit of talking, do something. Chop your thing up into pieces. So you're not lecturing for a whole hour before students, you know, fall. They're going to fall asleep in the first 10 minutes anyway. So what you can do is try and intersperse those little things. Try a video instead of talking about it. Try something else like that. Questions and discussions, and watch for cues. When people start to nod off, that's generally a cue that you sort of should get active and you should do something. If people are not connecting you through their eyes, if you sort of you can get a really good sense across the crowd what's going on, pay attention to those cues. There's nothing worse than the lecturer talking like this. And then the next thing we're going to talk about, never looking up. That's exactly the opposite of what you really want to do. You really want to leave the notes there. Get involved with people. Get close to them. Move up the aisles if you're not tethered to it like, you know, the podium like a dog, if you can. Now, I want to give you an example of this slide. Okay, so here's an example of this slide, because we're going to talk about PowerPoint for a few minutes. Same slide, okay? Next one. Here's the same slide. Guidelines for informing. Show the big picture. Orient learners. Cover a few points. Make explicit transitions. Engage participants. Short lecture blocks. Watch for student cues. See how much better that slide is than the one before it? What's the difference? Cut everything out. I've chopped out a lot of the words that were there, a lot of the text that I was saying as an example. So that slide versus this slide, it's a big, big difference. And it's amazing how much of a difference it is. It says exactly the same thing. And I can sort of elaborate a little bit, but it gives everybody the clue about what I'm talking about. Now, rather than give you a long explanation about how to do this and how not to do this with PowerPoint, the best thing to do is to actually show you a video. So I'm going to show you this particular video here.
That there's some things I hate about PowerPoint, and I figure it's kind of my duty to point them out. So here we go. Here's common PowerPoint mistakes. Number one, people tend to put every word they are going to say on their PowerPoint slides. Although this eliminates the need to memorize your talk, ultimately this makes your slides crowded, wordy, and boring. You will lose your audience's attention before you even reach the bottom of your first slide. Please don't do that anymore. Please. Number two, most common. Many people do not run spell check. Big mistake. Nothing makes you look stupider than spelling errors. If it's got a red line under it, recheck the spelling. And then finally, I hate this. Avoid excessive bullet pointing. Only bullet key points. Too many bullet points, and your key messages will not stand out. In fact, the term bullet point comes from people firing guns at annoying presenters. Hence the bullet point. Bad color schemes, not good. Clashing background and font colors can lead to distraction, confusion, headache, nausea, vomiting, and loss of bladder control. I can't stay on that one too long. Here's something I've noticed. The number of PowerPoint slides you have in your talk, the less useful your talk actually is. Unfortunately, my presentation is right there. I've also noticed this. People love to pack data into their presentations. They just shove more and more data, thinking it's better, but it's not. The more data you have, the harder it is to read your slide, and the effectiveness plummets. Now, you can improve the effectiveness by adding some shading and some 3D effects, and then some second-order and third-order effects, and then, I know, let's add some labels. That'll help a lot. And that's pretty much every marketing slide I've ever seen right there. Yeah. Then some like VP of marketing stand there going, it's real clear in Q4. What the hell are you talking about? Now, I'm into in animation. People become animators in PowerPoint. You can have things flying all over the place, and that can be good. If you're a visual learner, that will improve the effectiveness of your performance. But if you're easily distracted, more animations, and people have no idea what you're talking about. They're just, wow, that is cool, wow. And there's regions here, by the way. There's the simple but effective region. There's the active but confusing, the effective but boring, the active but ineffective, the dull but static region, the busy but useless, the ADD-only region, the useful but amusing, the stupid but confusing, the dull triangle, the hyper triangle, the sleepy square, the dizzying pentagon, and everything else I just call pointless motion. That slide right there took me an hour and a half to make, right there. PowerPoint can just suck the life out of you. It's amazing. I've also come up with this. It's a kind of a little science I've invented called font analysis. Basically, the font you choose says something about who you are as a person. There's a huge list of fonts, and you choose one, and that says something about you. So be careful the font you choose. For example, if you choose Courier New, which happens to be my favorite, you're probably organized and structured. If you choose Matisse, it means you're artistic. And if you choose Times New Roman, it means you're lazy, apathetic, and unimaginative, and you always use the default. Oh. A lot of Times New Roman people. Welcome. We have some more. If you use freehand script, you're a horrible speller, so you try to hide it with a hard-to-read font. Very smart. If you use Gothic, it means you're very pale and you wear black. And if you choose Wingdig, it means you're a nerd and you have no life. In fact, if you know what those symbols mean, you will never have a date. Trust me. Don't bother.
So that gives everything you possibly need to know about PowerPoint in a very funny and sort of interesting way. But just if you want to sum it up in a couple of big pieces, there's no real rules. There's only guidelines. So there aren't really rules for PowerPoint, but there are a lot of guidelines. And you can break them, but you sort of have to be aware of that. The key thing about PowerPoint is that it's not for you. It's for everybody else. So that means it should not be the place for your notes. Your notes do not belong on a PowerPoint slide. You should never, ever, ever have to read your slides. Your slides are a guide. And the guide is a guide for you. So people should be paying attention to you, not paying attention to the 1,000 points that you have on your slides. Use the presenter view as a good example. If you don't know what that is, Google it. You'll figure it out. Basically allows you to have a whole bunch of notes here, what slides are coming up, what slides are going back, and at the same time being able to show that there. One of the things that people do with their slides is they actually have their following. They don't know what's coming next, so you're clicking the bullets to find out what you're going to talk about. One of the worst things that you can deal with. When in doubt, use pictures, not text. And if you have to use text, use as little text as you possibly can. When in doubt, cut it out, right? And animations are like Tabasco sauce. You know, a little bit, okay. Lot, your mouth's on fire. Same idea. Try to keep it simple. And that's really the final one, which is the KISS method. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. simpler it is, the better it is. Great example of a slide. Here's a great example of a slide. If I was going to talk about Facebook and I was going to talk about the impact of social media, that's the slide I want behind me. Not a PowerPoint bullet points about it. If Facebook were a country, it would be the world's third largest. Pow. It's sending a message and then setting everything up from then on, as an example. Other things that you want to look at, Presentation Zen, great place to go. They've got great examples of good slides, good examples. TED Talks, another great example. And actually, if you look at TED Talks, they have a lot of bans on PowerPoint and TED Talks, as an example. A lot of people will just talk, or they'll talk with one thing on the slide. Some of the best presentations are